I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. And we're on a mission this hour, taking the experience of the superstorm on the East Coast and trying to leap outside of the recovery zone. What does this storm say to you anywhere in the United States about how government is working, how it's not working? How dependent are you on electrical power? How dependent are you on digital sources of information? Your smartphone, your cellular network, has it become a lifeline? Could you do without it? People on the East Coast and communities all over the recovery area are learning just how deep their dependency is. Think about it for a moment and then join our conversation at thetakeaway.org. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, facebook.com/thetakeaway. You can tell we're pretty dependent on all those digital channels. But we'd love to hear your impressions from Detroit, South Florida, Atlanta, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Oregon, Boston, everywhere else you can hear The Takeaway. But let's begin with the power grid. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo told New Yorkers last night that a huge piece of the infrastructure, from mass transit systems to the electrical grid, will need to be rebuilt.
We can replace the bricks and mortar. We can repair the beaches. We can repair the subway tunnels. We can repair the bridges. We can build, and we are doing that. There are a lot of people who want to help. Federal government is a great partner to us. There are resources that are coming in, and there are more resources that will be available. So we are going to be okay. And I believe there's a silver lining to this storm, which is we will not just rebuild, we will build back better.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, okay, we'll rebuild. We'll rebuild better. Why didn't we build better to begin with? That's part of our mission this hour. But still, 3.75 million people have entered a third day without power in the recovery zone from Superstorm Sandy. And with the utilities and power companies scrambling to get their systems back up, communities are taking matters, shall we say, taking extension cords into their own hands. Here's our friend Donna from Hoboken, New Jersey.
I really want to say thank you. I mean, they must have had about, I'm not kidding, maybe well over 2,000 people. I mean, the blocks, they just put out power cords. They came out. Do you need a shower? Do you need a bathroom? Do you need food? They were just awesome. And I'm going to tell you, we were there in tears today, in tears. People had no power anymore at all.
What Donna is describing there in Hoboken is a block that had power, sharing heat, and sharing its 110-volt outlets for people to recharge their laptops, smartphones, tablets, and iPads. She spoke to us last night. That's what's going on in communities throughout the recovery zone. But getting on the digital network once your appliance is charged is another challenge. And in places like Hoboken, there is no cell service in many areas. The same in New York City. When you drive into a dark power outage zone, as the light goes dark, you can also see the bars drop from your smartphone and then no service at all. Verizon Wireless issued a statement saying that 6% of its cell sites remain down in storm-affected areas. T-Mobile said roughly 20% of its New York City network and 10% of its Washington, D.C. network was down. And when asked by reporters about its service, AT&T declined to specify just how much had gone out. Julia Pfaff, an adjunct professor at George Mason University in Virginia, joining us from Alexandria, Virginia. You may remember we've already met Julia Pfaff. She's one of our independent voters monitoring the election for us. So we'll speak with her about politics a little later this hour. But Julia, how dependent do you think you are on all these digital appliances, these networks? And are you noticing any cell phone problems there in the D.C. area?
I have to laugh. Hello. We're really dependent on our phones. We have four smartphones in our family. We have a landline, but we don't use it. Everyone has their phone with them in their pocket all the time. So, and sometimes it's funny because you laugh and you wonder, well, what did we do before the cell phones? I think we've been lucky in our house because we live in a little pocket. We don't lose our electricity, but our neighbors sometimes do. And we've done the same thing where we've, you know, invited people over and that sort of thing. But our cell phone coverage here has been fine. I went out and about yesterday, went to Arlington, had no problems.
All right. Well, we'll be checking in with you in just a moment about maybe some other aspects of your dependency on the infrastructure. That's Julia Pfaff, an adjunct professor at George Mason University in Virginia, one of our voices of independent voters around the United States we've been checking in with as we prepare for an election. That's right. There's still an election coming next Tuesday. Nancy Scola also joins us, correspondent at The Atlantic, covers politics and technology. Nancy Scola, what would it take to have a more robust cell network in events like this, where a storm, it's a Category 1, still a huge record-breaking storm, but nevertheless, why couldn't this have been planned for a little better?
You know, one of the challenges with a cell phone network is it might seem sort of amorphous and just sort of floating in, you know, floating out in space to those of us who use our cell phones day in and day out. But one of the challenges is it's really made up of nuts and bolts sort of infrastructure. And when a city floods, like our city has flooded over the last couple of days, it swamps the cell towers. Things are underwater. We had a big push in the last couple of years to put up cell towers in the subways, which people were pretty excited about. And, you know, when those are underwater, they're just not going to work. And as you mentioned, the power supply is a huge deal in New York City. The way our city's built, these cell towers typically don't have independent power sources, or they might have small emergency backup generators. So when the power goes out, they just stop working. And you know, it's a calculation we've made, because having a ton of generators in the middle of New York City isn't something we necessarily want. I mean, when you put a cell tower on top of a building, do you want to put a generator next to it? I mean, that's a calculation that's made. So it's just, you know, to be honest, it's just not a system that's built to withstand the flooding of a city. If we wanted to build a system like that, it would be way more expensive and way more involved.
Well, let's talk for a minute about why that is the case. I mean, Julie, I believe, has a landline that she never uses, but the dial tone on that landline, I believe, is unaffected by a power outage in her utility. Why are the landlines on a separate power system, it seems to me, and cell towers not?
It's just the way the system's built. I mean, if you look at landlines, one of the things you have to remember is, if, you know, many of us have cordless phones, those aren't going to work when the power's out. But it's just the way that the cell system is built. It's independently powered. You know, it's something that doesn't have the same sort of connection, sort of like, you know, fiber connections that the typical landline system does. And it's just the way that it's been built out over the years. And it's, you know, it's a pretty fluid system. It can scale up. It's scaled up to serve millions and millions of New Yorkers. And some of the choices that were made just to build that on the base, the back of our electrical grid, which generally is a good idea. I mean, generally it holds up pretty well. If you look at, you know, one of the big examples that people look at when you look at telecoms use in emergency situations is Haiti, right? And Haiti, in some ways, you know, that was a big rush. A lot of emergency responders went in and tried to get their telecom system back up. But one of the things they actually had going for them was, because their electrical system is so bad in Haiti, it's not dependent on their electrical grid. So, you know, we've just made a choice in the United States that generally 99% of the time we can depend on the electrical system to work. So we built a cell phone network on that skeleton.
Although, and we're talking with Nancy Scola, who's a correspondent at The Atlantic, who covers politics and technology, is there a political issue here in the sense that in the 90s, when the cell nets were being built and the government regulatory structure for wireless phone systems and cellular networks was being contemplated, wasn't a decision made to fundamentally deregulate that entire system? And so if there had been a moment to say, it's got to have these minimum requirements of robustness, we decided to punt on that and let the companies do it themselves.
We did. And you know, it's a choice that has led to sort of to some good things for consumers, and potentially it's a freer market. I think that's fair to say. And, you know, one of the things I was talking to one of these disaster experts last night about, you know, what could the FCC do? Which is really sort of the agency that we worry about here. What could they have done differently in this situation? And they really do let the companies, you know, sort of run free. You know, when you look at when the iPhone came out in New York City, again, we had a huge problem because millions of people bought them and the system wasn't set up to support them. And I had an iPhone that literally could not make phone calls for a couple months. So, you know, the FCC could say, okay, if you guys are going to sell X many iPhones in the New York City area, you need to put up more micro cells. You need to, you know, build up the infrastructure to be able to support that. You can imagine how that might limit sort of the rollout of something like an iPhone if the, you know, Apple suddenly has to track how many cells iPhones they're selling in this area.
Nancy, let me just interrupt you there. If AT&T in the old days, remember the old scary AT&T when it was basically the only phone company, right? If they had sold phones to people on a network that didn't work, it would have been a gigantic scandal. They wouldn't have been allowed to do that.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's just a very different system. And part of that is that, you know, we depend on phones. As Julie was saying, we depend on our phones for a lot more these days. I mean, in the old days, our phones couldn't, you know, pull up 3D maps from any point in the planet. You know, they've sort of let the market run free in the hopes that the companies and the people that are sort of using the company's infrastructure are going to innovate. And I think we've seen that. I mean, we've seen that on the dependence. When you think back to, you know, I was thinking back last night, I got my first cell phone in 2000. And then in 2001, you know, obviously September 11th happened. We just weren't nearly as dependent on cell phones as we were back then. And, you know, it's part of the challenge that we've seen in New York over the last couple of days is when people weren't able to make phone calls, a lot of them gone on to Facebook, right? Which places, you know, a text message is a very small bit of data. A cell phone is a significantly larger bit of data, but going onto Facebook is a fairly huge amount of data. So, you know, our dependence sort of increases it sort of has this, you know, the cycling effect that we're so dependent on this infrastructure, we turn to it more, and that puts places more demands on the system. In the old days, you made a quick phone call and you were done. It's just, you know, it's not as robust, and we've made trade-offs to get to the point of being that robust.
Nancy Scola, correspondent at The Atlantic, covering politics and technology. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Julia, let me quickly just ask you one question. Is it my impression here? I'm in the middle of this Sandy recovery bubble. Is it your impression that we're at a moment right now where it looks like the commercial deregulated systems are down and it's the government systems, the public sector systems that are actually working right now? That's the impression from inside here.
That wasn't necessarily my impression. And it was interesting some of the things that she said, because when we had the Del Rey show here in June or July, what was interesting is our cell phone coverage worked, but our landlines didn't.
Interesting. Julia Pfaff, adjunct professor at George Mason University in Virginia, talking about our sort of national impression. How dependent are we on some of the electrical infrastructure that was so threatened and damaged from Superstorm Sandy? Julia Pfaff, will be talking with her a little later on when we explore some of the politics of all this. Julia, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
And we're hearing your stories about power loss, empowerment, keeping the quality of life up when so much of that quality of life is powerless. Here's Merle from Coney Island in Brooklyn.
My quality of life, on one hand, is zero, but on the other hand, is really wonderful. Because in my situation out here in Coney Island, we have no power, no running water of any kind, no electricity, no heat. But what I have is a husband of 30 years, and I forgot how wonderful he is until the lights went out. Because this man is trying to find a way to get it done with nothing.
Merrill from Coney Island in Brooklyn, how dependent are we on electricity or on our spouses and partners? If there was a blackout where you live, what device could you not live without? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. How do you vote when your polling place is underwater? More on that next.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.